Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Cochran, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this virtual session of the Court of Appeals for this April 8th panel. The first matter on for oral argument this morning is Weiss versus State of Minnesota, Guy Gosch. I'll just state for the record what the parties are aware of, which is that we are hosting this argument online rather than live at the Minnesota Judicial Center in recognition of the ongoing emergency status of the pandemic. And so counsel should be aware that even though we can see each other now, we are only making an audio recording of the presentation today, and that will be uploaded. So just as if you were here, I ask that you state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so we can keep track of who's attached to which argument. I'll just point out also that I've had a little glitchiness in my feed today, so I'm not sure if I'm being heard clearly. If it ever turns out that during the course of the proceeding that you're not hearing me or not hearing either of the other judges, just wave your hand and or alert us somehow, and we'll try to fix the technological issues. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Otherwise, unless there are any other issues, we're ready to proceed with the appellant's argument when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honor, and good morning to everyone on the court. May it please the court. It's an honor to be in front of you this morning. I got into this case because I had a friend who was doing habeas cases. He does a lot of criminal work. I do mostly civil. So although these are, I think, technically civil cases. So I kind of got into this case and I asked myself, how did a miscarriage of justice occur in this case? And I looked at the case and the record very closely. And I really think that maybe looking at the testimony of Dr. Gary Davis, which is exhibit number 5, it's at AA 17 to AA 40 of the addendum, really illustrates what happened in this case. The public defender basically agreed to admit exhibits 1 through 3, which were the medical record from the hospital regarding the rape. And
Mr. Dahl,
can I pause? Oops.
Go ahead, Judge Ross. Sorry.
Can I pause you there for a minute?
Yeah, of course.
Before you get into the merits of your argument about injustice, I'd like you to focus on the legal question that we're focusing on based upon, I think, what the state is asking us to do, which is to consider the procedural posture of this case. I'm wondering what your position is as to whether this is an appropriate habeas petition or whether instead it is a collateral attack on a conviction based upon arguments that have been repeatedly raised in the district court and this court.
Well, I filed a reply brief and basically the state's argument is a canned brief. And the fact of the matter is he never raised these arguments before in the other brief because he didn't have his IFP granted. And they were different arguments. So what happened is he started the IFP, but he didn't complete it. He actually didn't get it all done.
But counsel, I think the question really is a habeas petition the proper vehicle to address the concerns that you're raising? I mean, putting aside what the merits of the concerns are, is this the right procedure or should it be raised, for example, in a post-conviction petition, which your client has already used?
Maybe it should. I'm not really even a criminal lawyer, but I'm going to tell you that the guy is innocent. This is a huge miscarriage of justice, and I don't know what there is to address issues like this if it's not a habeas petition. I mean, this...
Mr. Dahl, but going back to the questions of Judge Ross and Judge Frisch, as a preliminary matter, don't we have to determine whether this is the proper procedural route to raise these issues? And Would you agree with that?
No. I think that the Supreme Court has made it clear that when there's a case of actual innocence today, that we're not going to allow procedural bars to stop justice from happening. And
have you,
go ahead.
Have you reviewed the Breeding case, the case Breeding v. UTEC, which I think establishes the principle that a petitioner may not use habeas review as a collateral attack on a prior conviction?
I've looked at the case. I'm not that familiar with it. I'm a civil, not a criminal lawyer. So what I'm saying to this court today is, I mean, if you'll let me finish my argument, I think you'll see that the justice in this case is such.
Mr. Dahl?
Go ahead.
I mean, I appreciate that you want to get to the substance of your argument, but we're sort of caught up in the procedural limitations, and it's like you want to attack the beaches of Normandy without a ship. You've got to get there first. So I'd like you to go back to Judge Cochran's question and Judge Frisch's question and mine, and let us know, can you, I recognize this is not an area where you usually practice, but nevertheless, are you able to cite a case or a provision in the law anywhere that would allow you as a matter of procedure to raise the merits of the argument that you'd like to present to us today on behalf of your client? What is the legal authority for your effort to skip over the procedural?
My legal authority is just the cases that say that when someone is actually innocent, they can raise that to the court if there's enough evidence there to do that. That's it. That's all I've got. I have nothing.
When you say
no,
when you say there are cases, would you please identify the case that stands for the proposition that you can raise the argument that you're raising in a habeas petition rather than a post-conviction petition or a direct appeal?
I don't remember the case. I cited them in my brief. And like I said, I'm not that familiar with these cases. I didn't review them from beginning to end. The lawyer that was in this case before me actually wrote this brief. He did an initial draft, and I fixed it and went through it. And I think there are several U.S. Supreme Court cases that allow this. U.S. Schlupp v. Dello, it says 130 Lawyers Edition, second 808. And then there's a Coleman v. Wilson, 477 U.S. 436. I don't recall. I really was prepared to argue my evidence. Can I at least get through some of that today, just to highlight a few highlights for the court? I don't remember. I'm just not that familiar with the cases. I want to tell you that what I learned from looking at the record, Your Honor, is that if you look at the testimony of the doctor, the medical records say that if he concluded in the records here at AA, I believe 34, his medical record says there was a sexual assault in the diagnosis. The record was admitted. The defense attorney allowed that to be admitted, and then he point blank says there was no penetration. There's no evidence of it. He says he asked him, all right, with regard to the sexual assault where anal penetration occurs, we've noticed injury to the rectal area by a stretcher or exaggerated or tear, just arrhythmia, irritated area, okay? And you didn't see any, and we didn't see anything. There was no blood on digital exam, no tenderness. And they did. And then he said, asked him about a DNA swab. There was no DNA swab done. They couldn't get a DNA swab. And then the first DNA test in this case says it's inconclusive. That test is not allowed to be entered by the court. Then they put in a subsequent DNA test right before this comes to court. And you can see the pleadings of the public defender. Then at the time after the public defender files his motion for a JNLV, the state doesn't even respond to it. And then the judge rules sua sponte, and Mr. Weiss has no representation at that time. I get the impression from a couple of judges that we've got to defend the rape victim, but if there actually wasn't a rape, there's nothing to defend here. I mean, I can see the looks on two of the judges, at least here, that they don't think this is anything at all, but I think it is a big deal. He's got a witness that the public defender didn't allow to testify that said this young girl was on drugs and she liked to steal.
Trudeau?
Yeah, go ahead.
I wouldn't read anything into faces if I were you, but in any case, on the matter of, aside from the procedural concerns that we asked about previously, I'd like you to address a different position of the district court, which was, in addition to this being the wrong procedural mechanism to bring these arguments, the district court concluded that these are essentially arguments that have been previously raised in the district court. And what is your position as to whether these are, in essence, the repackaging of the same arguments that have been previously made and decided upon?
I would say that they were the same arguments made in the appeal, in the original appeal. As far as in the previous habeas case, which we were talking about, and I addressed this in my reply, it's not the same arguments. And the state did. I noted that they just provided a canned brief, and they didn't show where that arguments that I'm making in this brief are the same. And so what I would say is that if the state really believes that these were the same exact arguments made in a previous habeas brief, I would note that this client only had the public defender for his appeal. And a lot of these arguments weren't made exactly the way that I'm making them to this court. I'm making these arguments to the court because I think it's clear that the DNA evidence was considered too much by the jury, and they didn't get to consider the other DNA evidence. And they read the testimony of the doctor into the record. So all the jury is looking at is an admitted medical record that says there was a sexual assault and a rape, but the testimony of the doctor says there wasn't a rape. There was a witness in this case directly that says this young girl was probably not being very truthful. I think I have more than enough evidence to just show that there wasn't, this didn't occur.
Mr. Dahl, I want to make sure I understood your initial response to Judge Ross's question correctly. I think you agreed that these same issues were raised in the initial appeal. Is that what you said?
I wouldn't agree that they were raised in the same way. I would say that they were raised differently than I would have raised them. I would never, if I was the public defender, have allowed admission of those records. I was practicing in insurance defense at the time this case was going on. And what happened was the public defender allowed in records that essentially expressed an expert opinion. in lieu of testimony. And then the testimony was off a cold record of a doctor's testimony read into the record. I would have insisted the doctor testify in person. I would have objected to the records. I think that was a fatal issue in this case. Then the judge sentences this guy to concurrent sentences of 45 years when the guy actually, the crime was committed before the enhancement statute was passed. And if he was convicted before that, he would have only gotten 90 months. He's already been in jail for 16 years. So he's been in jail for more than double the time that he would have got because he was improperly sentenced. So that alone is, I mean, maybe it's appropriate to enhance these cases, but I look at this case and I go, wow, there's a perfect storm of things that happened to this gentleman. The sentencing, I believe, is completely screwed up. I believe he got sentenced for crimes he didn't commit, and he got sentenced concurrently for crimes, consecutively for things that should have been sentenced concurrently. I mean, I think there's some implicit bias in this case just because this occurred in a small county, and my client was Hispanic. I have to say that before I end this case, because it does not appear he was treated fairly, in my opinion, by the court, and I think it resulted in a judgment that was wrong.
Thank you, Mr. Dahl. Your time has expired, but you will have an additional 5 minutes to use for rebuttal if you'd. Counsel for the state.
May it please the court, counsel, Corrine Wright McLeod on behalf of the respondent Guy Bosch. It's clear from Mr. Weiss's habeas petition as well as his appellate argument that he is challenging his criminal conviction. He's raising issues related to his criminal trial. He wants his conviction overturned. He's requesting a new trial and potentially an outright acquittal. And it's well established that a writ of habeas corpus is just not available for that purpose. I don't have much to add that's not already in respondent's brief. So unless this court has questions, I would simply respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's order. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. McLeod.
Oh, wait, we have questions for you.
Just briefly, in response to a question from Judge Ross, Mr. Dahl identified a couple cases that he thinks supports his position that the writ of habeas corpus is the proper mechanism for raising the issues he's raising. Can you briefly respond to that argument?
Those cases, in my opinion, do not address that issue. I really can't address that, Your Honor, that those cases to me do not seem to get to the issue at hand today. And I really can't speak to them.
Thank you.
Thank you. It doesn't appear to be any other questions from the panel. So thank you for your argument. Mr. Dahl, any rebuttal?
Yes, I mean, I think that if they really felt that the arguments were the same that were made before, they should have included at least some evidence, or they would have had a copy of a brief or something in that regard. I think that the court in this case, it's easy to look at the addendum which I've attached. There's critical evidence that wasn't put in. The reason that he didn't actually put in the evidence of the woman that says she would believe that she was lying, Melissa Jean Baker, was because she had a felony conviction. I have to say to this court.
Mr. Dahl?
Yeah, go ahead.
Would you please identify for us the arguments that you believe are new, raising issues that weren't raised in the previous habeas petition, not arguments that you say are presented in a slightly different way, but actually new arguments on issues that weren't raised in the previous habeas petition. Would you list those for us?
I think all my arguments are new to the previous habeas petition. The previous habeas petition was made, it was argued that there was no jurisdiction because because there wasn't a proper indictment. That was what the nature of that petition was, and that's what they hired that attorney to do. And I put that in my brief, and I believe I put that in my statement of the case. And that was actually what was going on there. In other words, I think him and a couple other guys had been to the law library, and they found something about requiring an indictment. And so they decided to try that. They hired a lawyer to do that. And then the court didn't grant the IFP, and he wasn't able to complete that. So that's what happened in that circumstance. My main argument today is that the sentencing was so out of line with what the sentencing probably should have been in this case, given the fact that the judge applied the enhancement statute, number one, and is sentencing basically to a life sentence. It's almost like giving him the death penalty for very doubtful testimony. And he's already served 16 years in jail. I mean, I don't think under any circumstances, probably my client ever gets out of jail without being under probation in any event. And really, all I'm requesting is an evidentiary hearing to this court so that you can make a fair judgment about this gentleman's claim of innocence and claim that there was a mistake in his sentencing. I believe he sat long enough in jail. I believe that it's clear that from the testimony of the doctor that
just to be clear, you're asking for us to administer an evidentiary hearing?
Yes.
And what would be the procedure where we would do that? You know, customarily evidentiary hearings occur in the district court, not in an appellate court.
I don't know how you would do that, but my understanding is that the appellate court has ordered evidentiary hearings that take place in the district court to review a matter. That would be my understanding of how they do that. I have never done this before.
Mine too. I thought you were asking us to actually conduct the evidentiary hearing, if I understood your argument correctly.
No, I understand. I understand you don't have even the means to hold evidentiary hearings in the appellate court. I think that there's a miscarriage of justice here, and there's really no other way this gentleman has to appeal this. And he certainly, if he did do anything, he certainly paid for it over and over. There's no DNA evidence, you would note in this case, that directly links him to this case. When you're looking, if you look at this and you look at the plain DNA evidence, they just found DNA evidence in the truck. But this guy had his friend's vehicle, and he said he'd had sex with a number of women in this truck. He denies to me that he had sex with this girl. He was just giving her a ride, and she made this claim. So the point I'm making to you is they just found his DNA evidence in the truck, not mixed with the girls. And it's very thin evidence.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're in recess until our next oral argument.